To David, my son, blessed of the Lord, greetings. My heart is heavy within me, and I fear that my end is near. The Philistines mass for war, and their numbers are like grasshoppers as they cover the earth. I've tried to reach out to your God without any answer through priest or prophet. And so I've returned to camp this night from a house at Endor, where lives an old woman who seeks to commune with the dead. In her trance, she spoke of an old man that must have been Samuel, although he's been dead these many years. I believe her when she spoke of my death in battle tomorrow. And I mourn for my life and for the fall of my father's house. The throne of Israel's king will crumble. The kingdom will wither and darkness will fall upon the hills of Gibeah. All is turned to ruin. Here at the end of my life, I do have regrets. All that was light and joy has been turned to ashes. My friends have forsaken me. The people are deserting me. Samuel once stood by my side, but he left me and is now dead and buried. God has turned away and will not hear me. I've driven you from my side, my son, and I can't help but wonder if my fortunes would have turned out differently if you had been here, fighting together like we did against Goliath. You always did have the best luck as a warrior. And you have a connection with the God of Israel that I never had. I charge you, therefore, with whatever life and breath remains to you, avenge my death. Take up the fight against these uncircumcised Philistines and remind them that Saul was worth remembering. In my last hours, I command it of you. We're starting our class tonight and our series for this year with a really interesting question. We're going to stop and we're going to think tonight about King Saul and about his experiences and about his wins and losses through his life. But the question I want to plant in your minds to start with is, how well do you know God? Have a think about that, and I think looking through your program for this year, I think you're going to be challenged this year in your understanding of who God is and what he's asking of those who follow. So we're starting with the life of King Saul and the dramatic reading, the pretend letter, I suppose, from Saul to David on the eve of his death was my attempt to inject some sort of regret, some level of bitterness, perhaps, of an old man who has lived a life that is now coming to an end. But we need to start even before King Saul. We need to start earlier than his birth. If you come back with me all the way back to Deuteronomy, you see, Samuel, as he was asked to provide a king for the people of Israel, explained to them what sort of king they would get. But we're going back even further than Samuel, back to Moses. In Deuteronomy chapter 17, he described how the king would act. He gave the people a prophecy. 500 years before the introduction of Saul into the record, God had written down what it was they would ask and why. And I think this is a really pivotal chapter as we stop and we think about how the kings of Judah started, how they all came about. So here we are in Deuteronomy 17. I'm going to start at verse 14, because this is God's view of what is going to happen. In verse 14, it starts by saying, "When you come to the land that Yahweh your God is giving you, and you possess it and dwell in it, and then say, I will set up a king over me, like all the nations that are around me. This is the scenario that we find Samuel in. So fast forward 500 years, this is exactly what's going to happen. And what takes place here in Moses' writings in Deuteronomy, that you can go through and read here, and I won't read it all. Moses spells out a couple of things. He spells out a list of requirements for the king. The king that would one day come. There was no question in God's mind that a king was going to be provided for his people. But this is the type of king that God wanted over his people. So the next few verses go through and give a few specifications. The first is they were to be a member of the Israelite nation. They were not to be a foreigner reigning over God's people. Also, a king was to limit the acquisition of, as it says there, horses and wives and gold. Now, not too many of the kings of Judah managed to limit their wealth and their power based on God's command here in Deuteronomy. But I find it really interesting as we go through and look at the remainder of this chapter. I want you to really focus on these particular words, verses 18 to 20. When this king that is going to sit on the throne of Israel is crowned, is anointed as king, he needs to do a few things, and you'll see them there in yellow. What are the things the king needs to do? First of all, he needs to write for himself in a book a copy of this law, the law that's approved by the Levitical priests. That's the first thing he needs to do. He needs to have his own copy of the law of God. Second thing, verse 19, he needs to read it all the days of his life. Third thing, in order that it's going to change him, he needs to learn to fear Yahweh his God. So those are three things that he needs to do. Anyone who would be king of Israel needs to pay attention and needs to focus on those three things. Make sure you've got a copy of the law. Make sure that you read it each day and learn from it. Not just learn information and facts and figures, specifically learning the fear of God. Why? That's going to come up. It's spelt out in this section. In order to learn this fear, you're going to do it by two things. Number one, keeping the words of the law, guarding them, keeping them close, treasuring them. Secondly, by doing them. Quite simple, putting it into action, making sure that it's seen in the way that you're acting. And the reason for this is, in green on the screen, two things. Number one, that his heart be not lifted up. And number two, that he be not turned aside from the commandment. And if you can stop and remember those critical things, then I think this whole study is going to become a little bit clearer. God's word, it says here in Deuteronomy, 500 years before Saul set foot on the earth, in Deuteronomy it tells us that God's word is the key to a successful reign as king. Now, how many of the kings of Judah are going to fit into this category? How many of them are, first of all, going to write their own copy of the law? How many of them are going to then read it each day of their lives? And how many of them, in doing so, are going to learn to fear Yahweh their God to keep them humble and to keep them faithful? And I loved the words of Daniel's prayer when he started this evening, because he said, it made the connection very strongly, that we are called to be kings. And I want to plant that seed as well first up, because what we're going to do is not just see a life that's lived by King Saul as an abstract. We're going to see in him the same challenges that we face. We're going to see in him the same victories and the same defeats that we face throughout the course of our lives. We're going to see good influences and bad influences, as we will find in our own lives. But the question is going to be, how embedded is the Word of God each day of our lives to keep us humble, to keep us faithful? So now we move forward 500 years from the time when the Israelites gathered around Moses to hear these words, through history to the time when the Israelites are again gathered together, and this time they're gathered around Samuel, demanding to be given a king. There's a very different vibe in this meeting. You'll notice, actually, and I've just compared it on the screen there, the similarity that the prophecy that God gave back in Deuteronomy absolutely came to pass. Where God told Israel in Deuteronomy that you will ask to set a king over you, like all the nations that are around you. And then 1 Samuel chapter 8, we find exactly those words. You're old, they said to Samuel. Your sons aren't going in the right direction, so make us a king to judge us like the other nations. The words of the prophecy absolutely came true. Like all the other nations. Just focus on that for a moment. It wasn't so a king could be representative of God for the people, to lead them in right ways of righteousness. The focus of this nation was on fitting in. The other reason they wanted a king was to lead them in war, specifically, so that they could have a figurehead going out before them, in order that they could go out and claim the wealth of the nations around them. It was all about security and building up their nest egg, and being one of the four foremost nations in the world. And Samuel's upset. Come over to 1 Samuel chapter 8, please. Samuel is absolutely upset. Chapter 8, verse 6, it says, "The thing displeased Samuel." And if you have a margin, then it may well say that the Hebrew word means that it was evil in the eyes of Samuel. Samuel could see that they were going about this the wrong way. They were asking the question for the wrong reason. And it's not a great start for a kingdom to begin, to say, this is these are the reasons that we want a king, and they're nothing to do with God. And so Samuel took this to God, as he always did, and shared his burden. Now, Samuel should have known better, right? A king was foretold. We saw that in Deuteronomy 17. There was no doubt a king was coming. In fact, you go all the way back to Genesis chapter 49, and you find that Jacob himself identified that there was going to be a kingdom. There was going to be a king. And that kingdom was going to sit at the feet of Judah. Okay, so all the way back in Genesis 49, then in Deuteronomy, a king is being foretold. Samuel should have known that this was coming. But the point is that it was not happening in the time frame that God intended. And I think that's another lesson that we learn. I think this is something that Jane and I had discussed quite a lot. We've been married for a long time now, almost 24 years. We discussed this quite a lot, this idea that God's timing is never what we expect. God has things set out in his own time, and we are usually a little impatient. We always want the next thing to happen. We always want school to be done. We always want, you know, find the right person. We always want to get a good job. We want it to be happening now. But God's timing is perfect. God knows what he's doing, and he knows what he's doing on a grand stage, on a world stage. So when we see at the moment Russia launching tens of thousands of troops sitting on the border of the Ukraine, and there's fear and terror through all of the newspapers and news articles that you read about this, we know that God's in control. But it takes another level of faith to understand that God is also in control of a micro level, of an individual level, for your life and my life. And that's something that everybody struggles with. That's a lesson that Samuel was trying to teach Saul all the way through his life. So Samuel is dealing with this request by the people, and he gives them warnings. He goes to them and says, be careful what you ask for, because this is what a king is going to be like. You notice the key word on that screen there is the word take. A king is going to take all of these things. He's going to take your sons to be soldiers in his army. He's going to take your daughters to be cooks and bakers to feed the army. He's going to take your best fields. He's going to take a tenth of your grain and your vineyards and your flocks and your servants and your cattle and your donkeys. He's going to take all of those. He's going to acquire that. And you are going to be his slaves, he says. Is that the sort of king that you want? And they said, yes, it is. Bring it on. We want to have that man out front with a sword and a charger leading into battle. That's the picture that we're looking for. Is it over the top? Is he setting false expectations, do you think? Well, actually, as it turns out, that was exactly what Saul was like. Saul went through and took out all of the best men out of the strongest men out of the nation, from all over the nation, to become his army. And he built up this fighting force because his focus was on war. Israel wanted a king to give them prosperity and wealth. Instead, he would take that from them. What I'd like to do is to just throw up a snapshot of Saul's life. I don't know how well you can read that from the back. Give me a nod if you can read it. Your eyes are probably younger than mine. Okay. So right at the back, we've got at least one person who can read it. That's good enough for me. So starting from the left and moving towards the right, and I haven't put any dates in here, you'll notice. We'll come and talk about that a little bit later, because dates in Saul's life are a little bit tricky. You don't get a lot of information about dates. Saul's journey as a king starts with donkeys. So it starts with a young man, maybe not so young, he's possibly around about 30 years of age, but a young man nonetheless, who is out looking for donkeys. And this young man is Saul, and he's there with his servants hunting for lost donkeys, and he stumbles upon the city of Samuel the prophet. Now, of course, Samuel knows, because God's told him that Saul is coming. And because the people have asked for a king to lead them into battle, somebody who was majestic, who looked good on a horse, who looked good holding a sword, that was the sort of king that God was going to give them. And so when Saul came towards Samuel's city of Ramah, and we read about this in 1 Samuel chapter 9, there's no donkeys to be found there, but he did meet Samuel for the first time ever. Didn't know who Samuel was. Saul doesn't come from a very religious background. He himself doesn't have very much idea about the God of Israel or anything to do with Samuel, who's been a prophet now for at least 20 years, if not longer. But he does meet up with Samuel, and he gets to know Samuel, and then Samuel surprises him. As they were leaving the city the very next day, Samuel surprises him by saying, "Just stop a moment, I've got something to tell you." And he pulls out a container of oil, probably a horn, and pours it on his head and anoints him. By the power of God, he anoints him as the next king, and Saul doesn't really do anything. He's a bit stunned. There's no reaction whatsoever that's given by Saul at this point. You know, somebody's come along and poured oil on your head. It's a little bit of an awkward situation. So Saul is a little bit stunned and doesn't quite know what to say or what to think. And then Samuel gives him a series of signs to prove that he knew what he was talking about, to prove that he was sent by God. He was God's messenger. And these are the things that are going to take place. So after leaving Samuel, he's going to meet two messengers who will give him news about his donkeys. Yeah, I haven't forgotten the donkeys. It's all right. Two messengers are going to give him news about the donkeys. Then he's going to meet three travellers who are going to give him bread and wine. Then he's going to go on and meet a group of prophets, and he's going to prophesy with them. What's he going to say? No idea. Saul doesn't even know any prophets. He's never met any prophets before in his life. He's got nothing to do with prophets, and yet he's going to become one of them. And then he's going to meet the whole nation of Israel and become their king. And as he walks away from Samuel, you can imagine his bemusement. But all of that takes place over the course of the next 17 verses as Saul moves on his way back through Bethel to Gibeah and then Gilgal. And this is his first experience. You can imagine running through his mind. He's thinking, what a strange encounter. I've still got sticky oil all through my hair. And here I am meeting these people along the way as I'm going home. What does it all mean? And what it means is that God is gradually working with Saul, gradually preparing him for the larger task of dealing with people. Bit by bit, two messengers, three travellers, a small group of prophets, before he sort of builds up to bigger and bigger crowds. Until such time as, verse 17, the people are called together by Samuel to a place called Mizpah, and there Samuel unveils the new king. Saul is declared to be king, and because as he stands up from hiding behind the luggage over in one corner, as he stands up, they realise that he's head and shoulders higher than anyone else, and he's built like a warrior, and they'll look at him and go, yes, this is the sort of king that we want. We want somebody big. We want somebody who can hold an extra, extra, extra large sword and swing it hard. That's the sort of person that we want as our king. That's what they got. They got a warrior. But this warrior was reluctant, and so as we find the events move on, he sort of disappears into the background. He heads off home. Everyone says, right, we've got a king now. We'll all go home and we'll look after our farms. That's it. Very exciting. And nothing happens. Nothing happens until, chapter 11, they are attacked by the Ammonites. And Saul is hearing the news, and he's moved to start to form an army, and he goes out and he wins a great victory. And so all of a sudden you have this national aha moment where they realise that actually a king does do something for the nation, and maybe we should pay attention to this. And so Saul is taken and is crowned king again a second time. Then there's a period of time, and I'm going to talk in a moment about this time period. A period of time during which Saul is learning to be king, working with Samuel, and we don't hear much about it in the biblical record. Which means that by the time we get to 1 Samuel chapter 13, Saul's been reigning now for quite some time, possibly around about 13 or 14 years, potentially. And he's faced with another challenge. This is the first challenge that Saul is faced with on his own, and it's a test of his faith, a test of what he's learnt over the time that he's been king. And he faces the Philistines, and it is looking like it's going to be a whitewash. He's got 600 men against tens of thousands, and he panics, and he goes and he on an altar that's there, he goes and takes the priest's role and offers a burnt offering on that altar, and as a result, he learns at that particular moment that he has failed the test. He couldn't wait for Samuel to turn up, and as a result, God will not set him up. God will not establish his house as the dynastic lead of the Israelites from that point forward. In fact, that's going to be, as you can see on the screen here, the first of three rejections that Saul has over the course of his reign. You might think, well, that's pretty sad. That's, and I've put them all down the bottom there, and you're going to keep, we'll keep referring back to those. Throughout the course of his experience, he has a great number of victories. His son Jonathan displays amazing prowess in the field in the field of battle. He has a great victory over Goliath with the help of David. And then he gets to know David, and he's got David as part of his household. But throughout, Saul is continuing to display a degree of faithlessness, a degree of self-focus rather than God-focus that is undermining everything that Samuel has tried to do. And I think that's the sad reality of Saul's story, is the fact that whenever Samuel thought he could take Saul that little bit further and help him to grow his faith, Saul stepped back, turned aside, and looked inwards and thought, what do I really want? Not what does God want? So a couple of things that I want to take out of this particular chart before we have our first reading, which is going to be from 1 Samuel chapter 10. the number of times that God works with Saul to try and convince him to walk with God. And then I think inversely on the bottom of that slide, the number of times that Saul is rejected because of what he chooses to do rather than following God. And I think those two things sort of go hand in hand through Saul's reign. So we might just stop and if you can open up at 1 Samuel chapter 10 and read the first 9 verses, please.
Reading 1 Samuel 10, verses 1 to 9. Then Samuel took a vial of oil and poured it upon his head and kissed him and said, "Is it not because the Lord hath anointed thee to captain over his inheritance? When thou art departed from me today, then thou shalt find 2 men of Rachel's sepulchre in the border of Benjamin at Zelzah, and they will say unto thee, The asses which thou wentest to seek are found, and lo, thy father have left the care of the asses and sorroweth for you, saying, What shall I do for my son? Then shalt thou go on forward from thence, and thou shalt come to the plain of Tabor, and there shall meet there 3 men going to God to Bethel, one carrying 3 kids, and another carrying 3 loaves of bread, and another carrying a bottle of wine. And they will salute thee and give thee 2 loaves of bread, which thou shalt receive of their hands. After that thou shalt come to the hill of God, where is the garrison of the Philistines. And it shall come to pass, when thou art come to the city, that thou shalt meet a company of prophets, coming down from the high place, with psaltery and tabret and a pipe, and a harp before them, and they shall prophesy. And the Spirit of the Lord will come upon thee, and thou shalt prophesy with them, and shalt be turned into another man. And let it be, when these signs are come unto thee, that thou do as occasion serve thee, for God is with thee. And thou shalt go down before me to Gilgal, and behold, I will come down unto thee to offer burnt offerings, and to sacrifice sacrifices of peace offerings. 7 days shalt thou tarry, till I come to thee, and show thee what thou shalt do. And it was so, that when he had turned his back to go from Samuel, God gave him another heart, and all those signs came to pass that day."
Thanks for that reading. So one of the things that I think is a challenge, Saul is such a flawed character. We know a lot about his faults, his flaws. It's easy and perhaps natural to focus on those negatives. His determination to do things his way, his pride, his rage, his jealousy, all of these things are part of a man who is rejected by God in the long run. But think for a moment about just how much God reached out to him in all sorts of different ways. One of the reasons I wanted to focus in on that reading just then was to not only give the flow of what he's experiencing and to understand what it is that Saul is seeing and feeling as he's leaving Samuel and thinking about what's just happened. There's a phrase in verse 6 that I think is really quite interesting. And I've got it there as the first pointy bit, the first benefit that Saul receives from God, where he's given another heart. In verse 6 it says, "You'll be turned into another man." What does that mean? He gets to be somebody other than Saul. Well, no. Verse 9 repeats, it says that when he moved away from Samuel, God gave him another heart, so that as he was going through that journey, he could see all those signs that were being coming to pass around him, and he was able to see them for what they were. That he was able to see a path that God had laid out, to be receptive to that. This is uncharacteristic behavior for Saul, to be so observant, to understand what it means that these people are meeting him and bringing him into the fold, making him part of their own company. Not only that, he also joined in with the group of prophets, which is something completely unlike something he would ever done in his life. This is not natural. This is a supernatural change that God has allowed him to feel what it would be like to have a true understanding of God, to have true fellowship with people who cared about God. This is what life could be like, and Saul was given this momentary benefit just for a short period of time to understand what his life could be like, to understand what a close relationship with God would be like. Notice, however, this is not Saul's choice. It was a gift that God gave him. It wasn't something that he chose. It wasn't something he actively went looking for. Contrast that, of course, with David. So the heart that David experienced through his life was not something that was supernaturally given by God. His heart was instead aligned with God. And have a look at these verses coming out of Psalm. Psalm 19. David says, without any supernatural interference whatsoever, David says this, let the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart be acceptable in thy sight, O Yahweh, my strength, my redeemer. Psalm 13, I have trusted in thy mercy, my heart shall rejoice in thy salvation. And then when he does fail later on in his life, David looks back and pleads to God, create in me a clean heart, O God. This is the words, these are the emotions of a man who wants to be like God, who wants to walk with God. Saul had that chance. Saul walked with God for those moments here in chapter 9, but he never continued with that opportunity. Time after time, God provides visible evidence for his support, or at least indications of his presence to Saul. And I've put a few of those in here. Dramatic victories over the nations around. I've also added that slightly smaller yellow hill, which is the regular guidance by Samuel. And that's something that will continue probably for the next 25 years of Saul's life. Samuel by his side, giving him guidance, allowing him to see the way a kingdom should be run in a godly way. So Samuel is that constant guiding light for Saul, and they grow quite close. So when God finally, after about 25 years, gets to the point where he can see that Saul will no longer listen, there's no longer any value in trying to teach Saul these lessons, Samuel is asked to separate himself from Saul, and Samuel is heartbroken. He can see that Saul had potential, but he never chose to step up to that potential. And Saul relied on Samuel as well. Interestingly enough, although perversely, he didn't rely on him enough to follow what he said. So even right at the end of his life, Samuel is still the one that he is seeking for answers. Now, I said I'd explore some of these dates, and my time is rapidly slipping away. Let me just go through this a little quickly. So using our timeline here, we know from Acts chapter 13 that Saul reigned for 40 years. We also know that his youngest son, Ish-bosheth, was 40 when Saul died. So what that tells us, simple maths, that Ish-bosheth was born the year he became king. Okay, so Ish-bosheth is born right at the left-hand side of this continuum here. We also know that David was 30 years old when Saul died, because that was when he was anointed king of Judah for the first time. What that means is that David was born after Saul had been king for 10 years. That makes sense? So 30 years. Now, that's helpful because we know when David was born. David was born in or around the year 1040 BC, which means that we can actually put time limits on the reign of Saul as to when that went from and to. Now, there's a conundrum, and this is an interesting conundrum, perhaps. Come over to 1 Samuel 13, verse 1. In my version, King James Version, it reads, Saul reigned 1 year, and when he'd reigned 2 years over Israel, he headed off to war. Now, you go and have a look, and we've probably got a few versions around the room, but I'll put a few of these up on the screen. Just have a read through some of these. Both the NIV and the NET translate this. Saul was 30 years old when he began to reign, and he reigned over Israel for 40 years. Now, I tend to agree with that, but that's not what the original said at all. So they've added in the words 30 and 40 just to make sense of the sentence. Where they got those? Unclear. The ESV, Saul lived for 1 year and then became king, and when he'd reigned for 2 years, two years over Israel, then he went to war. Pretty sure he wasn't a one-year-old child when he became king. So that's a bit suspect. The Douay Rheims version was even worse. Saul was a child of 1 year when he began to reign. Okay, so you can see there's something going on with the translation of this verse that is a bit of a challenge. The Young's Literal translation. Who prefers Young's Literal? Yeah, not many people actually say yes. That'd be great. It's really complex because what Young's Literal is trying to do is to give the exact literal translation without any added meaning into the wording. So the Young's Literal says, "A son of a year is Saul in his reigning, yea, 2 years he has reigned over Israel." Now that's actually going to help us try and come to grips with whatever is being said here in this verse. And the answer comes from an understanding of that phrase, the son of a year. It's used a number of times in the Bible. Sometimes it's talking about animals that were of a certain age, and so in some cases it's referring to an age. You know, somebody could be a son of 20 years and they would be 20 years old. In this case, is obviously not the case because Saul wasn't 1 year old when he became king. So we can strike out that particular way it's used. In other cases, this phrase, son of a certain year, marks from a particular event, from the reign of a king, or from a particular world event, like the earthquake of Uzziah. You know, that was a well-known event, and they would mark time from that particular moment in history. We use our modern calendar as a point of reference, right? So when I say I'm a child of 1975, that makes me look really old, but I don't need to explain to you that it's 1975 AD marked from, you know, the start of our calendar system, because it's understood. You get that, I hope. Otherwise I'd be 1975 BC, which would make me very old. So the question is, what is the reference point here? A son of 1 year, it has a reference point that isn't explained. What's the reference point? And I'm going to inject our timeline back in here. Here's another point. Assuming that Saul is no more than 30 when he becomes king, that would put his oldest son, Jonathan, as about a 10-year-old, let's say, roughly speaking, when Saul becomes king. So if Saul is going to be king for 1 year, and then 2 years later he goes off to battle, and Jonathan is going to be the captain of his army, it doesn't really make sense that Jonathan would be 13 years old and the captain of the army. So that isn't going to be the way we need to read this. So save a little bit of time. I'm going to suggest to you that the most valid reference point is actually the birth of David. This is the first rejection that Saul is experiencing as king. What that means is that all of a sudden here we have a shift. One king moving to another king, and so this is becoming the start of the Davidic era. And so now Saul's time frame is being based not on his own kingdom, but on the kingdom, on the life of David, who is God's preferred king. And what that means is that what we're talking about, if we are looking at the birth of David, so Saul was the son of a year, the son of 1 year after the birth of David, and then 2 years later he goes off to battle. That means that he's been king for 10 years when David is born, plus 3 years. He's been king for 13 years when the events of chapter 13 actually take place. That makes it easy to remember, 13 and 13. Wasn't what I was going for. So a suggested translation here is a son of David's first year is Saul in his reigning, and then 2 years later he goes off to war. So the meaning is that Saul reigned for 1 year after David's birth, and then 2 years later he goes off to war, and that's the war that's talked about here in this chapter. I hope that makes sense. Otherwise, just say nod yes and keep moving on. What I was trying to do was to understand how the time frame of Saul, and particularly these verses, fitted in to into the reign of the kings. And that makes sense because we find the next battle, Jonathan is, yes, he's young, but he's the battle leader. This makes sense because Jonathan would likely be in his early to mid-20s. So he's likely to be around about the age of 24 when he's going off to battle and leading the people. So let's move over to 1 Samuel chapter 14. We have this this massive force that is arrayed against Saul. The Philistines have stunned Saul into immobility. Chapter 14, verse 2, we find that Saul has stopped. He's tarrying at Gibeah. He's not going anywhere. He's got 600 men with him. That's the extent of his army. And he's doing nothing. Jonathan, on the other hand, takes one man, his armor bearer, and goes down a gully and up the other side to take on the Philistines on the other side of this gully. He's climbing up the rock face, and he gets to the top and he kills 20 men who were guarding that plateau across about half an acre of land. Now, it doesn't sound like much, but fighting after you've done that uphill climb, vastly outnumbered, with the disadvantage of lower ground, that's quite a feat. Not only that, Jonathan says to his armour bearer, "Righto, I'm heading up, you come behind me." Normally an armour bearer's job was to carry the shield and go in front and protect him from arrows and things like that. But Jonathan's faith in God is demonstrated in chapter 14, verse 6, where he says, "It doesn't matter to God how many there are who are going out to fight, as long as somebody goes. It doesn't matter if there's many or few, God is the one who's going to win the battle." And Jonathan's faith, in contrast to Saul here, Jonathan's faith is absolutely proven. And because of Jonathan's faith, God was able to use that to then step in and take a hand in the battle. And there's an earthquake in verse 15. You can read this chapter later on. The earthquake quakes the ground and destroys the morale of the Philistines who run away in confusion and start fighting each other in the ensuing confusion. The rest of the chapter, though, is all about Saul's pride. Saul sees this and says, "Right, I'm going to have vengeance on my enemies now," and off he goes and creates chaos, essentially, in the Israelite ranks. But you see a pattern here that starts to crop up more and more in the life of Saul. He does things his own way, doing what seems right to him, not considering others around him, and definitely not thinking about God. From this point on, Saul becomes the warrior king. And I think as we move through, looking at the events of chapter 15, the army has grown not to 600 men, but to 200,000. So he's pulling men into his army from all over Israel, and he builds this amazing force, and that is Saul's legacy. Saul becomes the warrior king with all of those men, all of those resources that he's taken from the nation of Israel. I'm going to actually skip over our next reading, watching the time. And if I ask you to come over to 1 Samuel 15, verse 23. The events of this chapter, Samuel has asked Saul to do a job for him. And the job is that Saul needs to take his amazing army, go out and destroy the Amalekites. And Saul does that. Except he likes the look of the Amalekite flocks and herds, and he leaves all the cattle untouched. He also leaves alone the king of Amalek, Agag. And so when Samuel turns up, he looks around and he hears the noise of the cattle, and he sees this this evil king of Amalek sitting there in on the ground at Saul's feet. And he says, "What is going on?" And the key verse here, two key verses, verse 22 and 23. Samuel asks Saul, do you think God's got delight in burnt offerings more than in obedience? Put it in perspective. What is going to be more important to God? Behold, he says, to obey is better than sacrifice, and to hearken, to listen, than all the fat of rams. God's not that interested in sacrifice as much as he is in obedience to what he has to say. And so the focus here in verse 23, the lesson that Saul needed to learn was that in God's eyes, rebellion is like the sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness is as iniquity and idolatry. Now you put all those words together, rebellion and stubbornness, both mean the same thing, essentially. They both mean doing what I want to do, pushing back on what God says. It's all about self-will, if you like. It's all about self-worship. Who am I going to choose to worship? The God of heaven or myself? And those are the two options. And unfortunately, what Saul continued to choose was to choose himself. And as a result here, this second rejection, because you've rejected the word of Yahweh, he has also rejected you from being king. It's not just a dynasty. It's not just saying your sons won't be king later. Right now, you've been rejected from being king, Saul. And that's much more specific than the previous rejection. Still, and I want to emphasize this point, what God is punishing Saul with here is not being thrown out and being rejected forever. He's just taking away from him the kingdom. Saul still has the option of coming back to God and repenting. Yeah? Because that's what God does. God puts opportunities in people's paths to turn around, to repent, to come back. God delights in forgiveness when he has the opportunity, when people turn around and repent. This is not the end of Saul's life. Saul will now live for another 10 to 15 years, through his 50s and his 60s, and that should have been a time for reflection. It should have been a time for wisdom to govern his actions. During this time, he's introduced to the young man David, who represented Saul on the battlefield and won the victory over Goliath. He grows close to David and treats him as part of his family and loves him. He trusts him with the job as his personal armor-bearer, his personal bodyguard. On top of that, we're treated to a view of Jonathan and the love and respect that Jonathan had for his father. Jonathan's always looking for the best in his father, always trying to win his father over. And yet, despite these positive influences in the last 10 to 15 years of his life, Saul sinks lower and lower into despair and paranoia and hatred and destructive, murderous rage. There are moments he seems to lift out of the gloom, moments when he was hunting David and intent on killing him. And twice, David had Saul at his mercy. And twice, David called out to Saul and pointed out that he was actually no threat. Twice, and these are some years apart, where it appears that Saul is jolted back into sanity by the mercy of David. But he always cycled back down into that despair and blamed David for everything that had gone wrong in his life. I'm sure deep down he felt conflicted and torn, realizing that he was being foolish, knowing that David acted honorably and hating him all the more for it. And so we come back to a question that I asked to start with. Saul goes through a series of experiences in his life and never really gets to know God. I think that's fair to say. Yeah? He never really gets to know God. The question that I asked to start with was, how well do you know God? Do you believe that he is willing to work with people for decades to win them to his side? It's a long time. Will he keep sending messages and keep putting circumstances in place to convince individuals to change? The evidence from Saul's life is that God will try again and again, year after year, to win people to his side. But God's not going to make that choice for us. He offers, but he won't compel. And so here's the learnings that I'm taking from my study of Saul. The first is God's message to those who would be kings, those who will be kings one day. Don't focus on yourself. Don't worry about power and status and wealth. Leave all the worry to God. Instead, get your own copy of God's word. Read it every day. Keep it. Do it. In order that you learn, what were those two things? Help me out. What are you going to learn if you're reading God's word every day? Two things from Deuteronomy 17. Humility and faithfulness. That's what you're going to get out of reading God's word every day. And be aware of yourself. Just as Saul wasn't, I suppose. Be aware of your tendency towards self-will and look for opportunities of renewal. And I just want to focus on one final quote out of Deuteronomy, which summarises quite nicely the thoughts, I think, that we've been looking at in the life of Saul. Deuteronomy 8, verses 17 to 18. Don't think to yourself, my own strength and abilities have produced all this prosperity for me. But you shall remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers, as it is this day.